The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Yes, welcome to Race Treaty. It's 4/8/2016, and tonight's topic is organizing strategies on a local level for human rights. And these last few weeks, we've had various hosts on Race Treaty, very dynamic hosts. It's been a while since I've been on. This is Robin Benton from Anti-Racism Media. And we'd like to start off the show with some background on something that I feel is quite unique about one municipal area, and that's Asheville, North Carolina. As you may or may not know, we've come to understand how the human rights legal framework exists in terms of international law, and that's based on disproportionate outcomes or disparate impacts. And in accordance with human rights law, if those disparate impacts or disproportionalities are seen through this aggregated data, then the government is compelled by law to come into compliance. But that framework isn't applicable in the U.S. under white supremacy. In fact, you know, we function under the civil rights framework. But something unique happened here in Asheville that sets the stage for somewhat of a experience on human rights on a local level in terms of strategies, and that is, a document came out, or actual report, called The State of Black Asheville. A local professor, sociologist, has created a class over the years called The State of Black Asheville. Aggregates data from people activity, somewhat similar to Neely Fuller, but in this instance, there are six areas, be it education, healthcare, housing, criminal justice, economics, culture. And what he's done over the years is compiled data pertinent to the African American community from all government sources, local, state, federal sources, county sources. And what has happened is a picture has evolved from this data called the State of Black Asheville, where you can actually see the diminishing population. You can see the 74% of expulsions from school are blacks. You can see that in the boom town of Asheville, a tourist destination, that blacks in the city own less than 1.7% of the businesses in the city. So what this report has done by extracting data from these various areas of people activity, you actually have now seen and have developed what I consider a human rights violations report by the content with no enforcement on a local level. In fact, we've gone through a political season lately in Asheville, state and federal, and there's been nothing but crickets concerning this data on a local municipal level. And I've been involved with the Black Lives Matter chapter here in Asheville, and we've developed a strategy, knowing now that we have this marker, this reference point in terms of data and information. We're not cherry-picking issues. We're not reacting to issues. I mean, that possibility always exists in terms of the police violence. state-sponsored terrorism and otherwise. But as we break down the state of Black Asheville into different areas like healthcare, housing, education, we can really focus on how these patterns have evolved by going back and now questioning the policies that drive these outcomes. In fact, these policies reside in local institutions, government agencies. That's where they reside. That's where they are developed. That's where they maintain as structural racism, structurally embedded in institutions that drive outcomes that at this point we feel can be projected on the downward slope for the African-American community. So that analysis has now evolved in our Black Lives Matter organizing efforts, and we develop a plan, and I'd like to share that this evening as to how we plan to approach this data. Also, I should say that the State of Black Asheville as a human rights report also reflects complicity, if you will, complicity with the leaders and these policymakers and these institutions in which they reside, the holders of the levers of power. And always there's attached economics, obviously, that flow with these various agencies and institutions attached to these policies. And we're seeing how a Black community is actually being driven into somewhat of an extinction statistically, and how it's affected in the spectrums of oppression under white supremacy as a cultural norm, if you will. Asheville picked it as a prime destination point around the country. And veil very thinly under that destination in the profile of that population is a strong LGBT community, which in response to the recent North Carolina laws concerning LGBT, but discrimination in general, have a very strong and loud voice in Asheville. And so that community flies under the cloak of white skin privilege, in fact, in Asheville, the prime destination point in America, because although the LGBT community here has a strong economic and cultural identity, it doesn't seem to have any affinity with the state of Black Asheville. And we relate that, obviously, to racism, white supremacy, be it structural or personal. So I want to go into a history, so to speak, of something that recently transpired here locally, and that is Black Asheville Mini Summit. What has happened is that Asheville, as many cities maybe, are separated, the Black community separated by age, separated by class, separated by religion, separated by gender preference. And what we've attempted to do in trying to organize these various segments of the Black community, white people might think all Blacks are alike, but we know we have a diverse set of experiences as people of color, as African Americans in this country. And everything in Asheville seems to be exaggerated somewhat in that there's a small Black population, and so the lines of separation are kind of really clearly identified, and it makes it very difficult because you have a Black church who's not really embracing the LGBT issues, and the LGBT community is stating that the Black church is not supportive of their issues, and it's all in the family of our Black Lives Matter movement. So getting back to strategies. So we've got a way now, and we'd like to see a model developed, actually, that can be followed in other cities on how to extract this data from these various areas of people activity to actually see a human rights violations report or a report on the conditions of the African-American community, not only in one area, but in all of these areas that affect institutionally the Black community. We feel like there's something still going on here, and we would like to see this model And by the way, this report, the state of Black Asheville, is generated by Dr. Dwight Mullins, a UNCA professor of sociology. And unfortunately, and I've spoken to him on one or more occasions concerning his report. Unfortunately, this data is here and it's evident. It's actually a conversation piece, in some ways, entertainment for the liberal community as he presents at various forums. There's never been any organizing or plans of action or a stand, politically or otherwise, taken by the local community, be it in government, politics, nonprofit sector, or in general. It's just a conversation piece, the state of Black Asheville. So we'd like to share some strategies in terms of how we can frame these violations that are going on pretty much in every major city with a human rights lens. So I'd like to introduce a concept in terms of capacity building, in terms of how we even affect meetings. Ordinarily, when a group of people come together, it seems our cultural norm is to set up this hierarchical norm of a facilitator, someone is taking stack, and it's a pretty much a hierarchical type of way of controlling a group of people in a meeting process. We've introduced something that's more indigenous in its history and in its approach. It's called Circle Forward. And we're trying to give everyone a voice. It's a self-governance process by which everyone has an equal voice as a process towards a decision. And so we introduce that, first of all, as our organizing tool in communicating in groups. And we recently had a mini summit with approximately 50 participants. We've had three phases of that summit. And what we were able to do, and on top of asking everyone why they were at the meeting and what issue that they were bringing to that meeting that they'd like to focus on, once we went through that round, we actually identified under the different tabs under the state of Black Asheville, education, healthcare, housing, we did breakout groups under all those headings. And people went into their particular group that they chose, and they worked that circular process as well in terms of identifying issues. We asked them the list of all the agencies, institutions, and nonprofits that they felt were associated with housing or associated with health care or associated with education. We tried to identify every agency, the nonprofit, government, and otherwise. Then we tried to identify on the other side of that column advocacy groups, potential allies, if you will. And as we processed these problems, the statistics were our reference point from the state of Black Asheville. I mean, this report is quite glaring. And so what we're able to do in these breakout groups is really kind of formulate an idea and a picture, if you will, was drawn of the local situation. And that the inner circle was the community, and the outer circle are all of these organizations and institutions and agencies that actually make a living off of that inner circle, that community, because they use linguistic racist coding to acquire money, like at-risk population, target group. And these nonprofits acquire funds to service this community. And yet oftentimes, and in the instance of this city, the statistics bear the truth in that the conditions of the people do not change. And meanwhile, ironically, Asheville has the highest per capita number of nonprofits in the country. And so as we identify these agencies and nonprofits that are writing grants or receiving funds to administer services to this community, we realize that this community is rich. It's rich in its own culture. It's rich in that it's actually feeding and fueling and enabling white supremacy, because the relationship of self-determination has not been established. And so people are feeding off the community. And so we've come upon some ideas. And the idea one is to formulate these reports that have come out about the State of Black Ash Show and identify not only the organization, but take it at the step level, excuse me, a step further in identifying the directors, the CEOs, the executive directors, and the board members, or identifying what funding source and what funders are actually historically are fueling these historically white supremacist institutions that maintain structural racism as a self-perpetuating machine that spits out outcomes of oppression year in and year out. And we've got it on documents here, statistically and historically here in Asheville. Very important insight how municipalities operate in the blind, allegedly, you know, of the people, in that we're always in reactionary mode rather than planning mode strategically on how to affect these policies, how to challenge the funders, how to decode the linguistic racist language that is used to identify a population and extract money off of that population under the premise of servicing, with no accountability. So we see pretty much all of these institutions are gatekeepers to the funds, to the resources, to the knowledge that would empower that community to engage in self-determination. And oftentimes, because of the education levels, economics, people have this stereotype, well, that's a poor community, they can't help themselves. Well, we understand in the dynamics of accountability that if you're making a living off of this community and you want to engage, you need a few tokens. You need to actually touch a black person that you've been writing these grants on to get them to interact in community empowerment or meetings. Then we want to recalibrate the accountability relationship. We want you to be an expert, a specialist, technical assistance, rendering mutual aid to enable this community until it can deal for itself with leadership development so that it can deal for itself in self-determination rather than a dependency relationship, which is what is often established. And as my mentor from the People's Institute, Ron Moore, has said, Ron Chisholm, black people, poor people don't really need more services and programs. Poor people need power. And that shocks people. Well, what are poor people going to do with power? Well, that's the whole element of self-determination and empowerment. So we've kind of bound a scheme, so to speak, and organizing efforts that we feel are somewhat unique, in that in these breakout groups, we're going to formulate surveys and begin an online and a citywide survey process of all these various housing communities, the people, to echo the State of Black Ashes reports. And with those surveys, we're going to then process even further a position paper with a human rights lens, and process a petition online and hard copy around the municipal area, and develop a list under area of people activity, a petition concerning human rights, and try to impose an enactment of human rights or a human rights commission based on the violations ongoing. Now, there's been a difficulty because most people see human rights as an international stage mechanism, and that usually, according to American views, human rights violators are some third world despot. But actually, the U.S. is a prime human rights violator in and of itself, and comes out daily in quoted language, from police killings to medical malpractice activities to all areas of people activity is manifest. And yet, we do not have a mechanism for enforcement. Dr. Vernelia Randall, a law professor, has given a lot of thought into how to effectuate human rights law into our daily lives. How, beyond waiting for the federal government, who does the song and dance of in response to the Universal Periodic Review of stating that we'll do better and this and this and that as some official statement, but there's really no law of enforcement for human rights violations in this country. So how do we get to the international stage, into the international courts, if you will, with our issues? And there's a lot of strategies that are going on. I shouldn't say a lot, but there are strategies, Scotty, that are going on with, like, Dr. Ansari's efforts with the human rights defenders and human rights monitors to start aggregating data in various cities to set up legal cases to bring before the international courts. So we're trying to also, Dr. Vanelli and I had spoken about a bottom-up strategy, and how do you enact, like CERD example, into local law? How do you leverage the city councils to enact human rights law? And we do know that in the past few years there have been instances, in Chicago comes to mind, under human rights law, and that was the Convention Against Torture, wherein the police had set up the off-site Holman Square where they were conducting tortures and totally violating due process. And they got busted, and I don't really understand how these people aren't in prison themselves, or the department shut down. But what city council did was extracted the language of the violations from the Convention Against Torture and awarded the victims, I think, $5.5 million. The point being, they used human rights, the law from human rights, our international law.
Robin,
what do you think about that, Scotty? Yeah.
Well, I was just thinking, you was mentioning, well, how do we implement these things and what strategies do we use to implement on a local level, you know, the human rights language and ordinances and codes and whatnot. So I guess the model would be Jackson, Mississippi, with, you know, former mayor, you know, he's passed on now, but what, Chokwe Lumumba? And, well, what process did they use? What strategies did they use to, because I've heard you and others mention on Race Treaty, this program, about, you know, that being one of the few cities within the United States that have adopted human rights codes and ordinances in their local governance.
Well, what's unique about Jackson, actually, it's like light years ahead, is that the whole city was declared a human rights city. So they're chartered as a human rights city, and it also became an immigration, a sanctuary, also to protect so-called immigrants, you know, from ICE and otherwise. Because most cities already are established under their own, you know, city council laws, we're talking about strategically trying to place human rights law in an enactment,
okay,
like step by step, rather okay than like declare the whole city human rights.
Well, how about the same way that cannabis activists were able to get ballot initiatives legalizing recreational cannabis or medicinal cannabis? I mean, the process is still the same in that you're changing law in that state. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, actually, let's differentiate state and municipal, because there seems to be a battle in North Carolina where the state says municipalities can't touch the monuments, the racist monuments.
Right.
The local folks can now discriminate on patrons, you know, and so you have the state imposing on municipal law or on municipalities. What the municipalities haven't done is see their own power by enacting human rights law, which should on a legal argument override these state laws. You know, you have three supreme laws of the land. You have the Constitution, you have conventions and treaties signed, and you have municipal law. So you're right. The fact that particular laws, say cannabis or otherwise, can be enacted by a majority of the population on a local level. So that's the basis of grassroots organizing, is to effectuate change on a local level. where we live, how you're immediately affected. So wherein Chakwe came in with a total framework of human rights in the whole municipal legal structure. So Jackson, Mississippi stands light and shoulders above the rest of municipalities who might entertain the possibility of enacting certain human rights laws. You know, speaking in reference to local laws, you have issues of children. One of my associates, Reverend Dan Buford, has he's aggregated almost 200 cases of police killings of youth 18 and under, not just blacks, but youth 18 and under, which puts it in a whole nother category in terms of international law and the United States violation of international law by state-sanctioned terrorism. And that is the Convention for the Protection of Children. And ironically, all the countries in the world have signed this treaty but the United States. This is the one treaty to protect children that the United States has not signed. They commodify children. They social engineer children. Pop culture drives children. Peer pressure and television or devices are the number one and two influences on adolescents. It's not even parents, school, or church anymore. So you've got an attack on our children, dumbing them down through the education system. They've commodified the black bodies from school to prison pipeline. And there is no protection for children under international law as signed by the United States. So that is another area in terms of human rights being applied strategically on a local level. As relates to ASHO as an example, you have under education, you have these glaring statistics on the local population example. Say proficiency in math, reading, retention, early childhood education, where they start doing those scripts for ADD or what's it called, the ADHD or the Ritalin, suspensions and expulsions, retention. Black students accounted for 57% of retained students as opposed to 17% for whites or 9% for Hispanics. Of the students without disabilities that received more than one out-of-school suspension, 70% were black, 4% Hispanic, 14% white. So what he's done, he's extracted data like from the U.S. Department of Education for Civil Rights, that office, North Carolina School Report. He's aggregated these data, put it up on a graph, and it shows a history of violations. Human rights violations. So we are saying, how do you go to the state when the state is the oppressor? How do you go to the federal government on civil rights where you have to prove intentionality? Or how do you get to what we all are born with, innate, given to it as birth? How do we retain our human rights and actually impose the power of those human rights on a local level?
Well, I was just about in certain cases, I was thinking perhaps filing civil lawsuits, but using human rights language. But I'm brainstorming here with you and just trying to come up with strategies and ideals and what have you. But I don't think that, I don't know if there is example or precedence of United States courts recognizing international law. I'm pretty sure there probably is if I really, really think about it. You know, in terms of, let's say, the family members of, let's say, victims of terrorism acts and what have you, and then the courts allowing these people to sue foreign nations in American courts for damages and whatnot. So they're applying, they have right. to be applying some mechanism of international law. And so well, my know, thing, Scotty, what yeah, about here ahead, though? Man. But what I'm saying here though, would that stand up in court? You know, are they only going to go by constitutional law or what the Constitution says your rights are? Or can we work in, you know, this human rights language?
In well, civil you know, lawsuits? More than the language is the jurisdictional issue, and you just brought that up. You have the international courts and the region for the Americas. And corporations are actually now functioning international courts to try to sue other countries for violation of their so-called personhood rights. And so you're asking the question that is the ringer, like how do we access the international courts of these violations? And how do you impose it on a local level? As relates to the treaties, the treaty language has something called a reservation, which is, yes, we agree to these principles of this law, but our own sovereign legal framework protects our citizens, and as in the United States, it would be the Constitution. But I've come upon an argument that I think should be posed as relates to the issue of reparation and white supremacy. The United States Constitution does not have any protection for social or economic rights. It's not embedded in language or otherwise directly in the Constitution. And those are the two areas that affect us in the issue of reparation, those economic rights, restoration issues, and then the social, which is living under a white supremacy framework that's constituted as such from the beginning when they identified the Africans as three-fifths human. So I say that seems to be a loophole to bring the United States to world courts based on their not having those constitutional protections for their citizens, so they can't stake that claim that the Constitution protects its citizens vis-a-vis human rights law. And that's kind of a loophole issue that is yet to be brought. But speaking as to how do you jump from local law to enforcement on international law, and I don't know what precedent I do know that, for example, in Detroit, when Canada actually Ontario crossed over the bridge, they went to the United Nations for the water shutdowns in Detroit because there's no protective human rights framework in the United States to protect African Americans. We're not a nation within a nation. We don't get a seat at the UN. So we had to get help from another country concerning our plight. So it's almost, we are prisoners inside this country, inside white supremacy, and without any legal recourse. If we use the white supremacy framework, it ain't worked till now. We're both in North Carolina, where folks is marching for voters, for protection of voters' rights. That's been eroded. So the civil rights framework we know has failed African Americans. There have been some monetary awards that have been dispensed over the years, but that doesn't change anything. And it comes out of taxpayers' money on top of that. We as a people don't have a basis as a nation within a nation status to take the U.S. To international courts for violations against our people. It's only a complaint and a pump and circumstance process called universal periodic review, where the idea is to shame the United States in the world, in the world citizenry, to shame the United States. But no one stopped to think that white supremacy has no shame. So how are we going to shame the United States when white supremacy has no shame? It's been ongoing. It was founded on no shame. And so shaming doesn't change the course of our history. Nor does reactions in terms of necessarily in protesting and just being victims. The Black Lives Matter movement has done a lot to bring attention to certain areas of the Black experience, but it's not really being a voice of the unified field of white supremacy as it affects us in all our areas of people activity. And has yet to declare itself a human rights movement, which is something I, as a bystander, have continuously observed and anticipated because the civil rights process doesn't work for us. So on the local strategies, Scotty, I would like to try to find out what I do know, though, in Minnesota, I think they changed some laws using human rights law where they stop expelling children from elementary school. I think Seattle has used some human rights law, and they have now ceased committing any youth 18 and under from prison. They've also stopped the expulsion in elementary school, where the beginning of the school-to-prison pipeline begins. And so we have seen some scattered models, but we haven't really seen a strong strategy to really bring in these human rights issues into a language embraced on a local level as the law. One of the also the advantages that people don't understand, because there's a parallel universe going on, and that corporations are actually financing the political process, and obviously they're set up in municipalities. They function in municipalities, unchecked for the most part. Especially in government agencies, you have the leverage of so-called civil rights. You know, you can't discriminate based on this, this, and this. But there's a less enforcement going on in the corporate world, where we spend a third of our life or more every day. Most people do, I should say, working for a corporation whose sole mandate is profit, has no ethical or moral element to its existence, and yet its existence has a status of personhood that now has human rights. And we are still have not gotten that campaign going to declare our human rights. Malcolm X spoke on it, and it was the last really revelation that he was really pushing in his transformative years. I mean, he was fully always in transformation. He wasn't like a static personality. He evolved, he learned, he expanded. And his conclusion was, Negroes is still marching for civil rights, and we have yet to establish and embrace our human rights. And really, on that simple note, we may wonder then why we are being treated less than humans by white supremacy, and how we have not taken a stand on our human rights level to confront white supremacy on all levels. It has to be a concerted effort. It's not just about the police. It's not just about the prison, it's the education, it's the media, it's the environment, it's all those areas of people activity. It's an actual unified field. So, you know, the strategy that I've really kind of gravitated towards with Dr. Randall is how to implement human rights law into municipalities. And you hit upon a good idea in that it's just similar to the marijuana issue, where with petitions and continued presence on a local city council, eventually it was embraced and enacted, because ultimately city council has to act in response to the people that voted them in. And this is where we feel like this petition drives on these issues, bringing it up under the shaming auspices of, here, your city is in violation of human rights, and here are the statistics, and here is the constituency and voice of a petition of thousands of people recognizing this and demanding change. And what change our options are available is enactment of human rights law under municipal law. And you're right, Jackson, Mississippi is the model in that it set itself up as a city. It declared itself as a human rights city, not just that it enacted a few human rights laws. It is set up as a human rights city. And this is where the patriots, the sovereigns, the tea parties, the conspiracy folks feel that the U.S. would be giving over sovereignty to the New World Order that's ran by the United Nations, and that we're giving up sovereignty by allowing human or international law, or demanding adherence to international law, which would take our sovereignty, which basically is white supremacy.
Yeah, that's cold. That's just a whistle, a dog whistle. so to speak. Now, they ain't talking about giving up their sovereignty, meaning that they want to be able, without interference, be able to practice racism. That's basically, it boils down to that right there. That's the issue that they have, because they fund the UN. Donald Trump's now complaining about NATO. And they can complain all they want to, but they fund these things, these organizations. They utilize them in a way to protect white supremacy. And so, you know, that's really what they're saying when they're talking about their word about sovereignty again with the International Criminal Courts. They don't want U.S. soldiers being indicted on war crimes outside of the United States, because we see here within the United States, well, they don't recognize human rights. And even if there are criminal violations, you know, well, they sweep it up under, you know, the war on terror, which isn't a real declared war. But they have made it, you know, the public accept that, and they operate under the same rules of warfare. So, yeah, those are my thoughts on that. You know, that's just them saying we want to be isolated from the rest of the world in terms of our law, in terms of what rights we give to what citizens. That's all that is, man.
The social construct of whiteness never was even legal till right after Bacon's Rebellion, where white became a legal entity. It didn't even exist as a culture or much less a norm. The same people that the same so-called white indentured servants became the enforcers of white supremacy. You know? So you're right. The sovereigns, they don't understand. And you mentioned something about the Patriot Act and 9/11 and the war on terrorism. All of those things that we live under now actually upstage a momentous, monumental period in the African American experience, and that was the Durban South African Conference on Racism, wherein the United States and Israel walked out. And weeks later, 9/11 happened and just wiped out that whole conversation, much less also focusing on why the United States and Israel walked out. Partially, Israel's trying to control the language, linguistic control, by saying that anti-Semitism is racism, you know, and then the attempts of the world body to cut out a universal definition of racism and codify it into law, wherein violators can be brought to world court, to The Hague. U.S. and Israel quickly walked out. 9/11 happened, and now, most recently, this past month, those organizing around the UN decade of those of African descent, which I always want to promote because that's the basis of this show, Race Treaty. There's going to be a decade, we're in it, 2015, for those of African descent globally to organize and try to call out white supremacy by international law and CERT. So recently they had a revisit of the Durban issue, and where when it folded or imploded, it was based on this and it was related also to white supremacy or racism.
I had a thought, though, since you brought up the Israelis and whatnot, and, you know, you're exactly right, you know, about the focus turn from talking about institutional global racism to now we're in this war on terror and what have you. But you were asking, you know, well, look at right now, though, the BDS movement, the anti-BDS movement, has been in the news lately. You know, last year, President Obama signed some legislation that had within it, and these are popping up in these trade agreements, that you can't boycott Israel. And that's like what you're saying, where they're trying to say any criticism of Israelis is racism or is anti-Semitism. And then the language they're using isn't even grammatically correct, because a Semite is a descendant of an Afro-Asiatic people who spoke Semitic languages. Okay.
Yeah, but for their purposes, they can't really say anti-Khazarian, because then that opens up the
right,
door. They confiscated by conversion of the Hebrew Israelite religion. Right. And so that's a whole nother thing.
But look at, though, my thing is, well, what's the strategy that they're using, that the Israelis are using to protect their racism and white supremacy internationally? So study that model and their strategies, and then, you know, perhaps those could be adopted to, you know, do the same for black people.
Well, you brought upon a good point, Scotty, in that if you follow the Holocaust industry, you will see how they operated in the world courts and operated against different various states in the legal realm to establish their victimhood, you know. And our victimhood is established historically from day one here, including the native indigenous population that was submitted to underwent genocide. And so, you know, again, there's no economic protections in this country under capitalism, and you can't have capitalism without racism at the end of the day. That whole exploitation of labor is still predicated on a framework of exploitation of a population that is non-white. That's historically, you know, a fact. Sister Dawati was on our show a month or so ago, and she's a chairperson of the subcommittee on racism. And there, in this decade, there are works, the idea of bringing a truth and reconciliation commission to the U.S., similar to apartheid, to try to maybe bring again, reintroduce reparations. But I maybe use a better language like restitution. And in this truth and reconciliation commission concerning racism and white supremacy, I personally have, you know, a vested interest in that. I feel that data should be aggregated from all areas of people activity, not only from government, federal, state, and local, but from corporations and civil society as well. And aggregate the data and actually see the algorithm of white supremacy and how it operates in violation of human rights here in the U.S. as it relates to the conventions for the protection of children, conventions against torture, the convention, because that in the convention against torture questions the whole psychological industry in the United States, where the majority of these social workers and psychologists are now working for the federal government under the Homeland Security umbrella, and they've been found wanting in the cahoots with the torture report. So you now have a structural, a field of study that is actually a human rights violator as well, in dealing in the mind sciences. And meanwhile, speaking of the mind sciences, there's been this evolved understanding now of implicit bias and how that drives outcomes in people's behaviors and decisions, and how people who harbor implicit bias are in levers of power in the government and the judicial system, not to speak that 95% of prosecutors who really hold the reign of power in prosecuting black folks are white, and 74% white males. So you have in the hands around these levers of policies and power is still white supremacy. And, you know, that brings up another issue, Scotty, that is really close to home for you, because you evolved this definition that's more this more definitive to me than Uncle Tom, obviously, or sellout, and that's proxy racism. So, you know, we're finally starting to see that these cities, that majority black cities, for example, that have high profile political and government officials that are of color, we don't seem to understand, and starting maybe to understand, these people are really maintaining white supremacy. That's what the whole assimilation process is about, leading to a monoculture. The monoculture is still white supremacy.
Right, so but they don't call it white supremacy. They call it American. That's what they mean by we're all Americans and we need to get rid of these different labels that divide us. No, they want you to assimilate into white supremacy, or at least accept it and whatnot.
Maintain it, bro. Maintaining it.
Right. And getting in where you fit in. And, you know, maybe you can make a lot of money being a, overseer and whatnot. And so, yeah, it is assimilation of people of color into a white supremacist mindset.
And part of that mindset also in differentiating and knowing white supremacy, like, people don't cry until they feel like they've been prejudiced. They had a personal experience. But in reality, most black folks don't want to dismantle white supremacy. They just want a better position in it. And see, that's being driven by our materialistic get the money, get this, and, you know, degrading our women, and it's all a materialistic objective. And yet, it's not rendering any benefit to us, actually, as a people. No, this whole process of buying into this system that's oppressing us. It is destroying the environment, poisoning our food system. You know, so that parallel universe of these corporations really need to be honed in on. And how are you going to create a poltergeist, an invisible being that has more power than humans, that has the protection of personhood, and has the right to control the political process because institutionally it has all the resources to buy candidates and place their legislation? I think that's called fascism, right? At the end of the day. And our world pursuits is called imperialism at the end of the day. But for me, from my perspective, no matter what the color of the characters on the Crayola crayon set, it's white supremacy. And we have a decade for those of African descent, and we need to really start waking up on how we can enact this ideal of self-determination on a local level. And strategies need to be formed. We need a national think tank, I think, to form some strategies. But Dr. Randall would like to do it in Dayton, Ohio. Again, using the model and communicating with Jackson on how to formulate and push power into the municipal setting. Because marches gets headlines. But petitions and action inside of your local level can bring about major changes.
And
I'm looking for that precedent, and I'm saying maybe we need to organize to establish further precedents for getting from up under this framework of white supremacy and finding some legal remedy.
You know, I'm a part of the 1 million conscious black voters and contributors movement, just trying to get 1 million unaffiliated, independent black voters and what have you. And so I feel like, well, I agree with you. We need to have people working in every area of people activity. Some people should focus on, I don't feel like, you know, because you ever hear the term a jack of all trades and master of none. So sometimes I feel like though individuals or organizations can take on too much work, and, you know, they aren't really mastering any of the areas that they're working on. So I ain't got a problem with people focusing on specialized areas, maybe one or two areas, three areas, what have you, because many of the areas intersect. But, you know, as I keep thinking about you saying strategies and whatnot, again, look at the Jewish model. Look at the Jewish model. And we know that in order for them to do what they're doing, you know, it takes economic resources, and they do, you know, the wealthy among them do pool their economic resources. They created the lobbying organization called the Israeli Political, what is it, the Israel, what is APAC? Yeah, American Israeli Political Committee.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the influence that they have on the political process. So again, you know, all I say is study them. Study those who have been doing it, been more effective at it than anyone else. I mean, man, they have really been engaged in some stuff, man, you know? And so,
well, they've also had the opportunity, they're very nationalistic. And
right.
So they've been able through Zionism to create a facade of a religion to associate their religion with the political identity under Zionism, you know. So they've been able to create a duopoly, if you will, of power, not only through the religious, but also the economics. But another factor is how they operate here, though. It's not just an up-and-up strategy. You've got major United States figures in our government that have dual citizenship. And right. with that dual citizenship, their allegiance is to Israel. And right. so they've got that. They've got the media arm.
Look, though, Robin. And so we got all of this black misleadership class up there in Congress. And they could have a just as those Israelis with dual citizenship that work in Congress. Come on, man. These, you know, where's the allegiance? Are we demanding that same sort of allegiance from these black people that come from out from among
us?
Not at
all. Not at all. You got the Congressional Black Caucus subcommittee trying to play like they're representing the black caucus endorsing Hillary, you know.
So we got some cleaning up to do is what we have, and we need to be building institutions to replace those. And then we could point to, let's say, 1 million conscious black voters and contributors and say, hey, I don't know why y'all talking to Congressional Black Caucus Political Action Committee, because they don't speak for me. They speak for the lobbyists. I can point you over here. These people right here, you know, you won't see a platform or what I support. You know, they speak more for me than, you know, Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson or
them brothers, man. We need a drop squad curriculum. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, reparations isn't about everybody getting a check. It's about being empowered to set up our own institutions to do deprogram the damage that's been done. Because another element of human rights law, mind you, is not just trying to maintain these rules and laws of protection, but it's also addressing the issue of disparate impact. Now, you have intergenerational trauma, post-traumatic stress. You have this you have the internalized inferiority, post-traumatic slave disorder. You have impact that can't just be undone by a check. It's intergenerational. It's built into culture, psyche, and identity. And so we do need control of our own institutions. And like I you know, kind of loosely said, let's use a drop squad curriculum. But deprogramming is in order, man. We need a reset. You know, we really, really do. And we're using the framework of a white therapeutic mental health framework that doesn't address our circumstances and maintains internalized superiority by the white service brokers. We'll never find the answers there. The reparation is starting our own institutions from ground up to address our own issues. And I mean, that applies in principles to community police, for that matter. I mean, you know, the only armed brothers that are going on are the Black Panthers. But I don't understand why there ain't a Black Rod and Gun Club through the churches or otherwise, hunting clubs or otherwise, for protection. You know,
yeah, it's you know, more than the new Black thing. Panther Party. You got the Huey P. Newton Gun Club as well. But you're right. I mean, you're talking about stuff Malcolm X was talking about. We know Robert Williams, you know, talked about that as well here in North Carolina with the Black Guard and whatnot. So we just had to bring, it's not that we haven't used these tactics before, but, you know, they, you know, pulled the okie doke on us with the civil rights. And now we don't even want to exercise the Second Amendment to protect our black lives. So we got a lot of work to do, Brother Robin. But it's been cool talking with you tonight, man. We getting ready to wind it down as we get ready to roll into the Lotus Place. So if you want to wrap things up for us and tie
I'd like to say that check us out next week. Anaji Mued, Dr. Mued should be back. We have an interesting lineup that we hope to keep the focus on the decade and reports on the decade of African descent as we move to aggregate data and media to find out the experiences of people of African descent worldwide and why we aren't gathering together to fight white supremacy on an international basis. So that's my sign off tonight, and I appreciate your involvement, and good night, y'all.
Mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the rain.